You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 91, WWDC 2017 Analysis, Part 2. Today on the podcast, this is our part 2 and conclusion of our conversation about the WWDC 2017 keynote. Lots to talk about with iPad and new hardware announcements and more. So stay tuned for that discussion coming up next on The Impromptu.
We now move to the largest segment of the episode, iPad. We will still talk about Mac. We avoided it, but we will talk about it. So iPad, huge, huge changes to iPad. They have done everything we hoped they would. The only thing I can say...
Well, hold on. Not everything. Home screen.
Okay.
Come on.
I'm getting to that. So they didn't dramatically change the home screen, which, okay. But the dramatic changes they've made elsewhere are large enough that I'm willing to forgive them on it and expect that they will perhaps revisit it in iOS 12. So,
well, it does feel that, and I'll just say before you go into this, that it does at least sort of add weight to the Pro name.
Yes.
In iPad Pro, it does feel like you can use this as a professional device now.
Yes.
With all the stuff that you're just about to talk about. So, why don't you, I'll let you get started here.
Okay. So, first off, like the main thing you will notice is there is now a dock on the iPad. It looks like the macOS dock. You can put whatever apps you want on it. So on the left, you have all of these apps that you've put on it. And then there's a little divider bar and it has three apps to the right of that. And these apps are apps that have been suggested by the system. So it could be an app you used recently or continuity from another device. So if you were looking at something on Safari on your iPhone, that'll show up here and you'll open it and it'll load that web page on the iPad. So this is all fully integrated. Then the magic comes when you open an app. So it just looks normal. You've got it running full screen, but oh, what's this? You swipe up from the bottom. There's the dock. And then... this is now how split view works. Instead of pulling up that stupid annoying thing from the right where you have to scroll through every single app. No. Now you can just pull an app from the dock, bam, split view. And then you can do that for two apps, obviously. So you've got the two apps running side by side. At some point, I feel like there will be three. If they make a bigger iPad Pro. And then you can actually bring in a third app as a floating panel. So that's like the new popover. So the third app can just sit on top of the two that are in split view. You can do whatever you're doing on there and dismiss it. And then go back to the two apps that you were using before. And then if you double tap to multitask, you now get the control center on the right and the list of all spaces you have open. So these are apps.
So this is like Mission Control
for
macOS.
This is essentially like Mission Control, yes. So instead of a list of apps, I like to think of it as a list of spaces because it doesn't just show the apps that were open. It shows them in the exact configurations they were in, including apps that were in split view. So you'll see here
yes,
at the
top,
I had Tweetbot and Reader running side by side. in here now, you can see Tweetbot and Reader side by side as a space.
Can you rearrange those?
No, not currently.
Can you create virtual desktops?
This is currently how it works. Obviously, with subsequent betas, sure, they could improve this functionality. They could add ability.
This is a start, but this is a, it's still, I don't mean to dismiss it and sound ungrateful, but this is a big deal, right?
Oh, yeah. So that's that part. So multitasking drastically improved. You can now create multiple spaces of multiple apps put together. They will persist on reboot. So if you reboot your iPad and open the new control center, you will actually see these apps remaining in the split view configurations you left them in. So that is saved to memory, and right, you can go back to them at any time.
No, obviously those apps are probably still suspended, but at least that's really cool that it saves that view. It remembers what you had open and what configuration.
Yeah. So if you have Safari and Notes, Tweetbot and Reader, those will all show up as distinct split view settings. So then the other major feature that it's just so great, drag and drop is now a system-wide feature, not only between apps that are split view, but also,
this is arguably one of the most exciting and probably useful features for people.
So if you tap on an app on the dock that has documents, it will actually show you the most recent documents that you looked at in that app. And then the magic starts when you tap and hold on one of those documents. It then becomes attached to your finger, and you can do something crazy like, say, move it into an app and then move it into a folder. Speaking of which, the other big thing that we needed from Apple for iPad, a file system. Oh yeah, you better believe we have a file system now. iCloud Drive is dead. Long live Files. There is now an app called Files. It is a user interface for what is a system level framework. All apps now have access to the Files framework. They can create their own folders. They can access stuff that's on the iPad directly. They can access iCloud Drive. With the release of iOS 11 in the fall, Dropbox will support Files, so you have access to all of your cloud storage services, and you can drag and drop files in between all of those. Plus, of course, with Sierra, we saw iCloud Sync for your desktop and document folders on your Mac. So if those are in iCloud, you can now access those from Files. Literally drag files from your Mac desktop onto an app on your iPad.
That's crazy.
And
I mean, this is the stuff we've been asking for, dreaming about for years.
And because it's a system-level API that's part of UIKit, it supports multi-touch. So if you open the Files app, oh, look, I want to drag and drop this file. Ooh, but also I'd like to take this file with me and this folder with me with this file. It builds a stack underneath your finger. So you can literally move files in and out however you want.
Yeah, I saw how happy Federico Vittici looked at the keynote.
Oh, yeah.
John Syracuse was posting photos.
Yep. So this is all made possible with the Apple File System, APFS, that was developed and implemented in iOS 10.3. So what APFS offers is instant duplication, instant cloning, versioning, snapshotting of files. And what that means is when you drag and drop a file, what you're actually doing is creating an instantaneous clone of that file, which you are then dragging and moving to whatever app you want. So a clone is not like a direct copy of a file. It is a pointer to the original file. So it's basically like a shortcut which is what allows drag and drop to be so fast enough to actually be used as a system level interaction. So you're moving that shortcut, and when you actually plop it down into an app and then edit the file, then it actually becomes a new file that takes up space on the hard drive. Before that, it's just a pointer to the original file. But once you make changes, then it becomes an actual file. And then it gets it starts getting versioning and snapshots. So not in the current version of macOS, but probably in the next one, thanks to APFS. That's the other big thing in High Sierra. They're now moving to APFS on the Mac. In the next version of macOS, Time Machine could just be a system level feature where you can actually roll back files to like the past 5 or 6 versions for every single file. Because the nice thing about APFS is it gives you that for free. It actually stores metadata for the file and shows what changes were made over time. So rather than storing multiple copies of a file, you can actually extract the file diff directly. This is just a system level feature of the file system, and just roll it back because it contains a list of all the changes that were ever made to that file. So you can just go back in time, and it doesn't take up any space hardly because it's just metadata showing changes. So unlike Time Machine, where it literally stored copies of each version of the file, there's now just this compressed metadata, and you have access to that instantly.
It's really impressive what they were able to do with this, and the fact that you can transition from one file system to another file system, and somehow everything works without anything breaking or exploding. I mean, it's kind of unreal when you think about it.
Yeah. It turns out, also at the talk show, they revealed that they actually tested APFS migration in 10.1 and 10.2. So when you upgraded to iOS 10.1 and 10.2, it actually partially ran an APFS migration on your device and then rolled it back. And then it dialed home and said, this went well, or something went wrong here.
Oh, that's interesting. I watched that, but I must have missed that because...
So they actually ran testing. They measured twice and they cut once. They tried it out. They saw where the problems happened in the migration, rolled it back. And then finally in 10.3, they were confident enough to go, okay, we're flipping this switch. Transition to the new file system right now. Bam. And it just worked for everybody. Like, I don't know of a single person that had an issue with the APFS migration on iOS. macOS might be a different story, just because obviously the Mac has drastically different files. You can put whatever you want on a Mac as opposed to an iOS device. There are also limitations to APFS.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's kind of a weird bug with Unicode characters in file names. So the more non-English your file name is, the greater the chance you have of running into this bug. So the problem is APFS doesn't normalize the characters.
I see. Is this a catastrophic problem?
It's not necessarily a catastrophic problem, as long as the apps do their own normalization. So before, HFS Plus did normalize the characters. So as long as you don't generate new files on APFS with weird characters, you're probably fine. But moving forward, if the app you're using doesn't support the file system APIs and doesn't normalize its own file names, you could run into an issue where you can have two files with the same name and they corrupt each other.
No, that's lovely.
Yeah. Like I said, it probably won't affect too many people.
Now, is this something that's going to get worked out?
I believe so, yes. So I think they'll probably patch it maybe in iOS 11.1. And
oh, you don't even think this is something for the betas to be worked out?
No. This limitation has existed for a while.
Okay, okay.
So ever since they first announced APFS, they mentioned that this was going to be a problem.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like a trivial fix either.
Well, no, it is pretty trivial. It's just any app that deals with multi-language has to be careful about how they normalize file names. Because HFS Plus isn't there to do it for you anymore. So with APFS, you just have to be more careful about how you're assigning those characters.
I see, okay.
So that you don't create file collisions. So like I said, it shouldn't affect too many people, but it is something to watch out for if you deal with files that are in different languages.
And the new Apple file system is now default on High Sierra.
Yes.
And hopefully no major applications break. In theory, they shouldn't if they're using the system. I mean,
yeah,
I cannot see anybody having substantial issues here. There's no reason for you to build an app that does something in a weird way, like in an atypical way.
Yeah, I mean, chances are you won't, but there's always that one app that decides right to be different and then it breaks your whole system. Hopefully it'll be fine. I haven't experienced any showstoppers, yeah, but that's me.
I'm sure Avid will add support in Pro Tools for
2020.
About 5 years.
Yeah. Okay, so back to iPad. Huge changes across all of that.
Too many to enumerate for this podcast and also hard to demonstrate because we're an audio-only podcast.
Yes, indeed.
But a lot of people listening to this show may be so inclined to install the betas. If you don't have a developer account, you can wait, and you will have to wait for the public beta, which will not be out till what, the end of June?
Yes, the end of this month.
Which is probably for the better anyways, because it'll be a little more stable than the developer betas.
Yes, and I would imagine we'll be getting iOS 11 beta 2 this Tuesday, and then beta 3 will probably be the public beta.
So I'm on the public betas and my phone has 10.3.3 right now. So is that out of beta now? Is that on the last? It went through quite a few changes. I think it's beta 2 or beta 3. I don't remember anyways. Still be working on it.
Yeah,
but it's just
I'm not 100% on that.
Just bug fixes, nothing.
I've tuned
major
that out now.
Yeah, I'm on 11. iOS 11.
I'm okay. I'm turned up
all
to 11 now.
Let's get back to this.
So yeah, huge software changes for iPad, but there are also hardware changes. They announced two new iPad Pros at WWDC.
A surprising amount of new hardware too,
including the 10.5-inch iPad Pro that totally didn't exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except it totally did. So the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, 10.5-inch screen, reduced bezels. The device is only slightly bigger than the 9.7-inch iPad. And key changes include a new A10X chip, which has 6 cores.
Didn't they call it the A10X Fusion?
Or yeah, something like that? They've added the Fusion
fancy
to
name.
It's the A10X Fusion, technically.
There's no conflict with the Gillette Fusion razor, is there?
Yes,
We've added 25 cores.
Yes. And then 10 blades. No. So the A10X Fusion chip has 6 cores, presumably 3 high performance and 3 high efficiency, like the quad core on the iPhone 7 that had 2 high efficiency and 2 high performance cores. So the A10X knocks it up a notch. It's a sexa-core chip.
Sextet is the right word.
Well,
sextet? I don't know right.
If something has 6, it's like a... Oh God.
Just say 6.
Yeah. Whatever. So yeah, 6 cores, presumably 3 and 3. And in the benchmarks, there is some surprising information, would it surprise you to learn that the A10X Fusion chip in the new iPad Pros is faster than a base level 2008 Mac Pro?
No, don't be ridiculous. That's not possible. It's not possible. Like, I don't believe that.
And wait, there's more. It is also more powerful than every late 2016 13-inch MacBook Pro, including the ones with the touch bars. A tablet chip.
In all seriousness, if you've listened to our previous podcast, I think you kind of get the sense of where this has been going anyways for a while.
Yes.
I mean, Apple has clearly a very advanced silicon design team, and they have been really pulling far, far ahead of the competition in performance for years now.
Yeah.
And we knew, you know, you look at Qualcomm and everybody else, and yeah, they make nice chips, but you know, there's only so many cores you can throw at Android. And
yeah,
it's not, I mean, this isn't really surprising.
No,
we knew they were going to get there.
We knew this day was coming. So now we have a tablet that is faster than the latest. Okay, not quite latest, because they just announced new Kaby Lake MacBook Pros that will inevitably be faster than this chip, but very recent top of the line laptops, this tablet is faster than them. It's not just this is faster than a MacBook running an M3, or this is faster than a MacBook Air running an old i5. No, this is a tablet that's faster than last year's i5 flagship laptop. So we finally reached a point where I think it's safe to say it's not a question of if, but when Apple migrates to use A-series chips for their laptops. And the key thing to remember here is that Apple has control of their silicon design. So instead of doing a software solution for x86 and x64 emulation, they can actually put that on the chip. So they could come out with a multi-core, drastically increased clock speed, increased thermal design, A-series chip designed for laptops that has on-chip hardware emulation for Intel apps. And then, well, I mean, the rest will be history, won't it?
Yeah, indeed.
Microsoft's doing essentially the same thing with Qualcomm. So they announced Windows 10 running on ARM chips. And there, they're doing a mix of software and hardware emulation to run Windows 10 native apps on ARM. So they showed, as an example, Photoshop running on a Qualcomm tablet. So there's no reason to think Apple can't do the same thing and do it better. So, yeah, it's
and
not
like we've said before, I mean, that's really just a matter of time.
Yeah.
And it's probably coming sooner than you think.
Probably. In fact, I would expect we'll see a MacBook.
Yeah.
Not a Pro. We'll see a MacBook first with an A-series chip. 2 years, yeah.
I think that's
probably
realistic.
2 years. I mean, the groundwork's been set in Xcode for a while. Setting ARM as a build target is not going to be that difficult. And they provide a stable migration path, and they say, oh, look, all your apps will still work. And then developers can migrate to ARM, and then they'll run even better.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be far smoother than the PowerPC to Intel transition, because instead of having clunky emulation like Rosetta, you're going to have a chip that can do hardware emulation, and combined with software emulation, that's going to run a lot better, a lot smoother, less bugs. It'll just work. Unlike Rosetta, which was really problematic. That was a rough time. I mean, it had to be done, but it was difficult. So hopefully this transition will be better. I don't see how it wouldn't be better, just based on the caliber of engineering work that's being done and that could theoretically be done on this. It's when, not if.
Okay, so what's next?
Okay.
Because there's a lot of hardware.
Yeah. So back to the iPad Pro. We got sidetracked. The new screen on the iPad Pros has something a little different. It's something that Apple is calling ProMotion, and these panels are running at 120 hertz. Not the normal 60 hertz or 30 hertz or whatever, 120. So these are extremely high refresh rate displays. And more importantly, they can actually dynamically shift their refresh rate without needing to completely redraw the screen. So for example, if you're in iBooks, mm-hmm. where you're just reading text and occasionally flipping a page, they can actually tweak that refresh rate down to something very low if they wanted to.
Yeah.
To use less battery power. Like, they could literally turn the iPad into a Kindle with like a really shitty refresh rate to read a book. And then the minute you get out of that app, it goes back to 60 again. And then when you're in Notes drawing with the pencil, it goes up to 120, because at 120, it allows the existing pencil hardware to have a latency of 20 milliseconds, which is 1 millisecond less than the new Surface Pen.
Yeah, it's impressive, and it's really awesome that you don't even have to buy a new pencil. You just get these performance improvements for free, basically.
Well,
not free. You have to buy the new iPad, but you know what I mean. You don't have to buy a new pencil.
You don't have to buy a new pencil.
I mean, the pencil alone is how much? $100 or something?
$129 here.
It's not cheap.
No.
So what struck me is really fascinating, though, is obviously the technical work that went into this, they had multiple issues that they needed to solve to get to where they are now.
Yeah.
And apparently they started on this like 3 years ago.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise
me. I mean, nobody saw this coming.
No, it's a big change. And honestly, I can't say I'm surprised given the work that they seem to be wanting to get into, which is VR and AR. Moving to 120 hertz makes a lot of sense if you're trying to do smooth VR and AR. Especially for glasses. So, I mean, if they come out with ProMotion now, and then they put ProMotion in the iPhone 8, they start putting it into Max, they put it in the glasses, we're talking about having this extremely smooth visual experience, particularly on the iPhone. So, they come out with the iPhone 8, super high-res OLED display, 120 hertz, you put that into a Gear VR-like headset, that is going to be the smoothest mobile VR ever made.
I think it'll be a while before we will see this on Macs.
Yeah.
On desktop computers.
Well, but no, I could see ProMotion going into like the iMac Pro or something. Like something that's really high-end. Maybe the upcoming Thunderbolt display for the Mac Pro. I could see them feasibly adding ProMotion to that.
I mean, and they've confirmed they're working on a new Apple display.
Yes. So that could honestly be the first desktop ProMotion device, because it's going to cost a lot anyway, and it'll probably be 8K, not 4K, not 5K.
It wouldn't surprise me if they priced that thing at like $2,000 or something.
$2,000, try again.
You think more for that?
I think
really
more.
For like 27 inch.
If it's an 8K ProMotion display.
It doesn't need to be 8K though.
It's probably going to be 8K though.
Why do you need that much resolution?
It'll at least be 5K.
Unless you're working with video. I guess maybe that's where they're going for.
That's kind of the point, yeah. Because then you can have two 4K videos side by side, which is crazy. But hey, if you're a video editor, that could be really important. So I think at minimum, it'll be a 5K display.
I can't imagine the eye candy of imagine dual 8K displays, 16K.
I don't even, then total. Presumably the Mac Pro would be able to run it, but.
God, the GPU involved in processing that.
Yeah, you'd need two GTX Titans probably. And even that wouldn't be able to cut it. Like, you'd probably need the upcoming GTX 2080 or
something.
Well, I was
going to say that maybe some kind of external GPU where you have multiple connected in series, you know, to parallel processing.
I'm not
or
sure it works like that. Well,
I don't know.
I mean, it depends. But yeah, that's the other big thing. So on Mac, Apple announced full external GPU support with Thunderbolt 3.
Honestly, I thought that was going to be a pipe dream.
I know. But remember I said, because NVIDIA did those drivers, it was a good sign? Well, here we are. So
here we are.
Now you can cram...
People are rejoicing.
Yeah, you can cram a GTX 1080 into an enclosure, plug it into your MacBook Pro, bam, you've got...
I think this is really cool, though, that we're seeing this shift at Apple, that they really, really want to care and focus on graphics performance. And I think they must have realized at some point, like, you know what? We really can't get to the next level without doing something drastic here.
Yeah. On that note, I am a little disappointed because their laptops and the new iMacs are still quite anemic in GPU performance. So, I mean, I think this won't be an overnight shift. It is promising that the new iMac Pro is going to have Radeon Vega, their next generation GPU. That's huge. The Vega is supposed to be much more powerful than the GTX 1000 series. So if the iMac Pro has that, it's going to be ahead. I mean, not for long, because the 2000 series is coming out at the end of the year, probably.
I mean, but this is how it is with the GPU industry, right? Because AMD and NVIDIA, they're always trying to leapfrog each other. So it's like at some point, you just have to buy something that makes you happy, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, Vega will be a huge leap forward. I mean, there's a reason the iMac Pro is going to cost like $5,000 because they've crammed.
Yeah.
The absolute cutting edge of technology.
All things considered, though, that's still a bargain, though. When you,
it is.
When you actually price out a Mac Pro with those kinds of...
Well, you can't build a Mac Pro with those components.
I know, so, but I'm just saying, like, traditionally, to get the type of processing power,
yeah,
you know, you'd be spending more, and you'd still have to buy a display. You get it's a computer with a free display.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's the thing. In the keynote, when they announced the iMac Pro, they said a comparable machine would be like $7,000. Somebody actually pieced together a machine on Dell's website, and sure enough, yeah, $7,000 for a workstation like that. And that's without a display. So you factor in the cost of a 5K high color gamut display, which I don't even think you can buy.
No. And you know what? I guarantee you there are, if not now, there will be naysayers that are going to be like, I can build a PC for cheaper. Those people probably haven't actually priced it out.
Yeah. If you price it out, the iMac Pro is a better deal because you're getting everything in the box.
Yeah. I mean, you can cut corners and get a cheaper computer. It's not going to be the same, though.
Yeah, of course. Like, you don't have to have a 5K display. You don't have to have a Radeon Vega, whatever. You don't have to have Xeon CPUs in your machine. You can build, like, a decent PC with an i7 and a 1080 and whatever.
Now,
but
an important thing that we should mention that I believe even the regular non-pro iMac allows you to upgrade, go beyond 16 gigs of memory.
Yes.
Can't you go up to, what was the ceiling? Was it all the way up to 128?
Okay, the Pro goes up to 128.
Okay.
The new iMac, I believe, goes up to
at least
32 or 64.
At least 32.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, even pros, use regular iMacs these days.
The best part, the current 5K iMac can go up to 32. I actually have 32 in mine, aftermarket.
Yeah, that's right. It's not officially supported, but the chipset, I think, can do
I think you can order one with 32. It just costs more,
a
lot more.
For some reason, I thought they were limited to 16. Maybe I'm getting confused with the notebooks.
Yeah, the notebooks are limited to 16. But the iMac, the current iMac, you can get it up to 32, I'm pretty sure.
And the MacBooks got upgrades too. right? Yes. They're finally moving to Kaby Lake.
Yes. All of the new MacBook Pros are on Kaby Lake. They're using Iris Plus GPUs.
Now, those can go beyond 16 gigs of memory now too, right?
No.
No?
No.
I thought they could.
No, the MacBook Pros are still limited to 16.
Even the top configuration?
Because they have to use low power DDR RAM. And even Kaby Lake doesn't support LPDDR4.
Okay.
So
next year.
Not even then, because the next chipset is Coffee Lake, and Coffee Lake doesn't support LPDDR4 either. So Apple's actually going to have to wait for Ice Lake that comes out mid to end of 2018.
It probably still won't stop people from buying these new MacBook Pros.
No, of course not.
Do you have better options? No, not really.
And thankfully, they did lower the price on some of the models. So the MacBook Escape, the one without the Touch Bar, is actually now, I think it was, yeah, it's like $200 cheaper here. So I'm not sure how much cheaper it is in the States, but it has dropped considerably in price, and it's gained a much faster Kaby Lake i5. So the one in the previous MacBook Escape was a 2 gigahertz i5. And the new i5 in the Escape, I believe, is a 2.4 gigahertz with a higher turbo boost. So you're going to get much better performance out of that machine than the previous one. Obviously, it still has just 2 Thunderbolt 3 ports, which, but you're getting fairly good value for money there. So, I mean, if you don't care about the Touch Bar, it's like $1,700 here. That's not bad.
Yeah, sure.
Especially considering that the MacBook costs that much, and it's way less powerful.
Yeah, and the iMac Pro does have more I/O, right? It has USB-C, additional USB-C ports.
Yeah, the iMac Pro is going to ship with 4 Thunderbolt 3 ports, I believe.
Now, which one got the SD card reader? The regular iMac has that SD card reader in the back? Or was that the iMac Pro?
iMacs had a SD card reader for a while.
Okay.
Or, wait, did they take it out?
I don't remember them having...
I can never remember what they do.
There are SD card readers in these iMacs, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, it... Maybe not the regular ones. I can't remember. Definitely the Pro. The Pro's going to have like everything. It'll be crazy. And, oh yeah, the other thing about the iMac Pro, it's space gray.
It does look really good in space gray, I got to say.
Yeah.
It's a shame the 27-inch and 21-inch aren't available in that color. No,
they wanted to make the Pro look special.
See, they needed that little extra touch.
Yeah.
That layer of icing on the top to get you to get you in.
Yeah. Also, they have finally shipped a Magic Keyboard with a number pad. Wireless keyboard with a number pad.
It's a big deal for pros.
Yep.
It sounds like a little thing, but pros care about that.
Yeah. I swear by it. Like, I love having a number pad. It's great, especially for inputting things like credit card numbers or phone numbers. So much better than hunting across the entire width of the keyboard to type out a number. It's just all right there with one hand.
And a big deal, no more spinning disks, fusion drives by default.
And there will obviously be options for larger SSDs at cost to you. SSDs cost a lot still. Less than they used to.
Oh, you know what? The cheapest 21-inch iMac still has a 5400 RPM drive.
Oh,
seriously?
God, that's the default, really?
But the base model 27-inch has a 1 terabyte Fusion drive now.
Yeah.
Which is good.
That doesn't surprise me.
$23.99.
No.
Canadian.
The new cheap 21-inch has a 1 terabyte drive by default.
Yes, a 1 terabyte 5400 RPM drive.
Oh.
Going to the details, it says right there.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay, that sucks.
Yeah, it's disappointing a bit.
Never mind.
But you shouldn't be buying such an iMac with a small screen like that. Go 27.
I've never been a fan of the 21-inch.
I mean, obviously, there are people that can't afford the bigger one, I guess. But
to
be saddled with that for so many years, I mean, yeah, it's the one computer you're going to have.
I just can't do the 21-inch. It's too small. Like I have a 27-inch iMac at work, the 5K.
That's a good size.
So good. That's why I'm hoping that they ship that monitor eventually, because I have a aging Thunderbolt display that needs replacing, and I've looked at the market and there is just no monitor that can adequately replace it.
Now, I don't understand why some people were confused at the keynote about the iMac Pro, thinking that the iMac Pro is like, some people were saying, is this replacing the Mac Pro?
Nope.
Because they did make that announcement a few months ago saying that they are working on a separate, even higher performance modular Mac Pro that is still coming.
Yeah. So you'll recall a few episodes ago, I mentioned rumors of this faster iMac that was going to have Xeon chips, right? So that's the iMac Pro. And that's going to be insane. Like, that's going to be way more powerful than any of the previous Mac Pros. And it'll be a great machine if you want an all-in-one that can do everything and anything you throw at it. But for people who want something even more powerful that they can tweak and upgrade whenever they want, that's going to be the Mac Pro. I'm not sure when they're going to be able to give us a first look at it. We might get a first look as early as the September event. They might do something similarly to how they unveiled the previous one, where they give us a quick sneak peek at it with like a little trailer, and then they put a splash page up. We could see something like that as early as September.
It'd be terrible to have a teaser, though, knowing that it's not shipping until 2018, though, right? Because they did say next year.
Yeah. I think worst case scenario, they give us a sneak peek at WWDC 2018, and then it ships in the fall. I think that's a reasonable timeline, because I don't think they necessarily need to do a ton of engineering work on it, because if it's going to be modular anyways, they may as well just have a standard socket so you can take the CPU out, put a new one in. Maybe they need to come up with a custom thermal design so that you can swap CPUs easily. Because normally when you're building a PC, you have to put thermal paste all over it, put the heat sink on. Super annoying, because then if you want to swap it, you have to use rubbing alcohol, clean the thermal paste off, put the new CPU on, put more thermal paste on, put the heat sink back on. It's a whole thing. So if we're going to have swappable CPUs, Apple's going to have to come up with a custom solution for that. So that might be complex. But then the rest of it, I mean, RAM, it's already pretty easy to swap on a regular motherboard. They don't need to do anything super fancy. Hell, they could just do the same thing they did on the 2008 Mac Pro, the cheese grater one, where it's just this tray thing that you slide out.
Yeah, I think there will be, but there will be innovations in certain areas, and then there will be some familiar things that we've seen before.
Yeah,
because they work.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like, how drastically can you change that?
Yeah, and then I think we'll probably see something similar to what they had on the cheese grater, where you have that little lever on the back and it pops open the case.
I still like it. I think there's a lot of good things to say about that,
like,
design.
I think we'll see little touches like that. I think they'll keep the thing on the trash can Mac Pro where the ports on the back light up with LEDs. That was a nice touch. I think we'll see it in the new machine just because it makes things easier. Like if you're back there trying to plug things in, if it's under your table, it's dark, you can't necessarily see all the ports. So that's a nice touch. I think we'll see it in the new one.
Like we've been saying, I think, I mean, this is just speculation, but I think it seems realistic that it will be some kind of hybrid. It'll be somewhere in between the extreme Mac, the trash can Mac Pro, and the tower, big honking tower, somewhere in between, like, those two designs.
Yeah, like it'll be this streamlined Pro machine, it'll be unibody, it'll probably have like some kind of premium finish. I could see it being jet black. That would be really crazy.
Could be space gray.
Yeah. That seems to be where they're going for
might
their
be. It might
pro
be this
hardware.
Trend.
So, I mean, we could see a space gray Mac Pro and a space gray Thunderbolt display. Yeah. That'll look really awesome.
So what else for hardware? We should probably keep moving on.
So
the MacBooks. I mean, there's not too much to say other than Kaby Lake, faster processors, better GPUs.
Yeah.
They made some substantial improvements on the integrated GPU.
Yes.
From what they showed in the benchmarks.
Yeah. So the new Iris Plus GPU in Kaby Lake is substantially better.
Like 80% or something like that?
Like it's way faster. It's obviously not up to NVIDIA or AMD spec.
No.
But
no.
It's a lot better than it used to be. And then...
Now, didn't they bring back the discrete GPU? Wasn't that gone for a while? I thought even the pros had the Iris graphics. They got rid of that switching.
Yeah, so the first Retina MacBook Pros only had Iris. Although I think maybe some of the 15-inch you could still get a Radeon. But obviously with the new lineup, the 2016s and these models, with the higher-end 15-inch MacBook Pros, you're getting a Radeon Pro GPU with the Iris. So you do get that discrete graphics switching. And with these new Kaby Lake MacBook Pros, they've drastically upgraded the Radeon Pros in the 15-inch. So it moves up quite a bit from where it was. The new baseline is like...
So it's Intel Iris Pro graphics. So is that a dedicated GPU? That's not a shared with system memory?
Oh no, that is like that's on the chip, that's on the CPU. But then if you move up to the 15-inch, the new baseline model, which starts at, oh my God.
I'm looking at the 15-inch on the Apple Store and it doesn't list anything about a Radeon chip.
I'm looking at the app. So the baseline now is $3,199 in Canada. And it comes with the Radeon Pro 555 with 2 gigs of RAM, dedicated RAM.
Maybe the app is, that's not what I'm seeing here. If I go to the Apple Store app, I go to 15-inch MacBook Pro, and it says, this is weird because it actually says, before I tap select, it shows Radeon Pro 560 with 4 gigs of memory. And then I select it and it shows Intel Iris graphics. That's gotta be a bug. In the app. Oh, wait, no, I clicked on the wrong one. Sorry, I tapped on the wrong one.
Yeah.
That's my fault. So Radeon Pro 560 with 4 gigabytes of dedicated RAM. That is the, is that the top of the line GPU you can get in these? It looks that way.
Yes, I believe so.
But I don't know anything about these GPUs. How did they stack up to the previous MacBook Pro?
I think it's like 20 to 30% improvement, something like that. The 555 that's now the baseline was the previous high-end option.
And I think they have bigger SSD options now, too. I think you go up to 2 terabytes.
Yes, I think so.
Though most people can't afford that.
No. Like, the 15-inch already costs $3,000 here. Imagine what adding a 2-terabyte SSD would do to the price. Plus AppleCare. You might as well buy an iMac Pro at that price.
So, I think that's it for hardware.
Yeah, pretty much.
We got it covered.
Yeah, that's all the hardware. Obviously, there were some other things. There are new Apple Watch bands. Woo! They finally made the Rainbow Pride Edition band available in Apple stores worldwide. Well, maybe not in certain countries that are less tolerant, but certainly in most countries it'll be available. They've also added the new Nike Sport Bands, the ones that match those new shoes that are different colors representing times of day. There's several quite striking options within that collection. There's also new colors for summer. Okay, so the new colors for summer are Mist Blue, which is a very, very light grayish blue, Pollen, which is a light yellow, and Flamingo, which is a light pink. Then for the Nike Sport Bands, the new colors that match, like these are special new ones that match a line of new shoes that they've come out with, new Nike Flyknit shoes, I believe. So they've got light violet with white circles. They've got violet dust with plum fog circles. They have the one that I ordered, which is blue orbit with gamma blue circles. So that's like a cool dusky kind of color with light blue perforations. And then they have an obsidian and black sport band, which is a really dark, even darker than midnight blue.
Yeah, that looks kind of nice.
With black circles throughout.
How many watch bands do you have now?
Too many. If Apple changes the watch,
being a bit of a collector there.
If Apple changes the watch connector, I'm kind of
like
screwed.
A drawer dedicated where you just pull out the drawer and you got like 100 watch bands.
Kind of
like James Bond. One watch band has a very specific use.
I have quite a few in my bag actually, because usually I'll swap at work. Like maybe on the way to work, I'll wear a sport band, and then while I'm at work, I'll wear something a bit fancier. Then they've added a new classic buckle color, sunflower, which obviously is a very vibrant yellow. So yeah, that's the summer collection of watch bands. Obviously, they'll refresh it again in the fall. And that means, obviously, that a number of options have been retired quietly.
As is normal with any company having product lines, especially fashion, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is what Apple's been doing for the past few years. They, every season, as with the fashion world, they come out with a new set of watch bands with different colors, different options. They do different things. Last year they came out with the nylon bands.
Right.
Those were brand new.
Yeah, you have your summer, winter, fall. I mean, you have collections for each season traditionally.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the summer collection. And then in September, October, they'll announce new bands to go with the Apple Watch Series 3. And then again in the spring, there will be a bunch of new ones. So the cycle will continue.
It may be time to wrap.
Yes.
For WWDC. Now, usually I watch the State of the Union speech or video, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I have not for this one. Have you? Usually where they unload a lot of technical detail.
Oh, yes.
A lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, there is a lot of detail. I've seen highlights. One of the big things that happened in the State of the Union was that they announced that macOS will be phasing out 32-bit apps.
I think this is going to freak out a lot of people.
Yeah. So they announced starting in 2018, all apps submitted to the Mac App Store must be 64-bit, which is not unreasonable.
I started looking through mine. I still have quite a bit, actually.
Really?
Well, they're weird. You know what's weird is Adobe a while ago transitioned to 64-bit for their apps, but like weird things are still 32-bit. Like why is the Creative Cloud Launcher app, the updater app, like why is that 32-bit?
Really?
It's 32-bit.
Oh, God.
But Photoshop, Audition, they're all 64-bit. Well, so, I mean,
I'm sure they'll be updating
but
that.
That's probably trivial for them to recompile something like the little updater to 64-bit. Like,
yeah,
come on.
Of course. I honestly don't think this will be a huge problem. Obviously, any apps that are regularly maintained.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It won't be a problem.
I think this is going to be a bigger issue for apps on iPhone, on iOS devices.
Well,
because there are a lot of people that use older apps.
They do. But unfortunately, that ship has sailed and the transition has already occurred. The purge has begun. In fact, it's already done. 32-bit apps are no longer on the App Store. If you have a 32-bit app and then you install iOS 11, it will not open. It is done.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't found replacements. There's some very useful utility apps here that haven't been touched in 3 or 4 years that I still use. There's no replacement for them.
Well, it's just too bad, I guess. Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I mean,
don't be rude. Don't be rude.
Okay. I mean, this had to happen. A lot of the changes in iOS 11 are really thanks to the fact that they only have to worry about 64-bit. Like, by freeing up the system, by getting rid of that 32-bit runtime, it's probably made room for things like the new multitasking and drag and drop and everything else. So, I mean, this was a necessary change. And sure, it doesn't surprise me that they're doing the same thing to macOS, albeit on a much longer time scale. So 2018, they're requiring that Mac App Store apps are 64-bit. Then I believe in 10.14, which I'm hoping is no longer called Sierra or anything related to Sierra, they will start warning users about 32-bit apps. Then, presumably in 2019, with macOS 10.15, they will purge 32-bit apps.
Yeah.
Or they go an extra year. I'm not sure. They might just have more aggressive warnings in 10.15, and then they get rid of it in 10.16 in 2020. But I would bet on it being sooner than later.
I want to do a closing thoughts because obviously we got, I mean, a lot of the stuff that you and I have talked about for I think the better half of the last year, stuff that we've been wanting for a long time in iOS, we didn't get everything that we wanted. You know, and we'll have to talk about this in a future episode, I'm sure. But I think overall, this was a very successful conference. I think that they made a lot of developers happy. I think for the consumers that were paying attention to the announcements, I think the general air seems to be at least some of that tension that's been building up. I feel like it's kind of like they've released that pressure valve a little bit. They've let that steam out and people are kind of like cooling off now. And I feel like, not to say that Apple's reputation was bad, because it wasn't, but I think a lot of those worries, a lot of those concerns about the direction of the company, what they were not working on, I think some of that, a lot of that has been lifted, really.
Yeah, I definitely believe that.
And I especially feel that with all of these foundational major improvements to iPad, with the new multitasking, all these productivity enhancements, I think that really pays the way for maybe iOS 12, where maybe we finally do see something substantial with the home screen. That they do have to get away, everyone knows, from this just grid, this plane. We've had this since 2007.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed.
I think we will see that. I think this foundational update is just, it's massive. And the thing is, they only have so much development time. So these were very big features to land this year. They've been working on this for a while.
Yeah.
And
I'm not ungrateful. I mean, I think they made, honestly, they did have to pick and choose what they wanted to, like sort of the big tentpole features they needed to work on. I think they did prioritize appropriately.
Yeah.
They just need to go to the next step. So I think what we got this year was really excellent.
Yeah. And I think we'll see that continue with iOS 12. Like, I think we will see more substantial UI changes in iOS 12. This was a foundational update. They've tweaked the UI a bit, but overall, this was about adding functionality, adding new utility, really changing the user experience story for these devices. And moving forward from here, there's just so much room for growth and potential now. Whereas before, it was stagnating. Now with this functionality, we have so much more room for improvement. So I think we will continue to see Apple iterate on this stuff. I think next year will be very exciting to see what they've come up with to add on top of this. And I think next year we will probably see Siri get better for sure. I know I say that every year. Siri obviously is a lot smarter in iOS 11 than it was before. And with the foundational improvements with Core ML, I think Apple finally has a foundation to start really building out that artificial intelligence platform and really bake it into every level of iOS. Like, it's not it's not just Siri, it's everything. With this framework, they can just kind of update all of their apps to start doing these intelligent things, sensing things about you, predicting things, suggesting things. That'll continue to improve over time. And I think we'll start to see really big features come out of that. Also, looking forward to September, I think we'll see some big names on stage for iPad. Obviously, the iPhone will be the star of the show, but I think we will see some big app releases for iPad with iOS 11. I think we'll maybe see Adobe on stage with a new version of Photoshop.
I sure hope so. They have to be.
I think we'll see Microsoft with the full version of Office, not just the tablet version. It'll be the new touch version that's on Surface. They will bring that version to iPad because of the new functionality so that you can have Excel and Word side by side, and you can drag tables from Excel over to Word. You can drag text over to Excel, vice versa. Put everything into a PowerPoint.
Yeah, like grab like a chart from Numbers and drag it into Word or something. Like it just pops in there.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
That's brilliant. That's what we want.
Exactly. And I mean, Apple will make those changes to iWork in the fall as
well. That's natural.
And we'll probably see a big update to GarageBand and all of those apps. So, I mean, this story isn't over yet. Like, we're going to see massive professional improvements to a lot of the big productivity apps on iOS for iPad. So that story is yet to be told. Yeah. And obviously we'll see some big changes over the next few months as developers start to soak these changes in and start updating their apps.
Yeah, exciting times. I'm really excited for the next 12 months. I mean,
yeah.
It's going to be great.
You've been listening to the Impromptu One Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for this podcast and the work that we do here, the single best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/hologramradio and donate today. Subscribe to the podcast in iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week. And do leave us a review if you have a moment that makes us feel good, as well as helps other people find the podcast. We're also available in Google Play Music, TuneIn, and Stitcher as well if you'd like to stream it there, and wherever else you can find podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I'm at Zero Distraction. And if you'd like to send us feedback the old-fashioned way, you can email us at theimpromptu@hologramradio.org, and that will go to both myself and Michael.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.